You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday, our last week of The Wire. I'm your host, Jessica, filling in for Rosetta, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Lou. Ifai Akine coming up on the show. This week, we bring you the best of The Wire, where we will be recapping the year that was in news and current events. First, we will revisit when Rosetta spoke to Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp about the election result this year, where Takutai won the Tamaki Makaurau electorate by just 4 votes, and Te Pāti Māori won 6 of the 7 Māori electorates. Lou, what have you got for us today?
Firstly, I had our weekly catch-up with ACT Party MP Simon Court on the recent protests on the smoke-free and fair pay agreement repeals. We then revisit our chat with Dr. Claire Henry and the rise of endometrial cancer in Aotearoa, as well as look back on our discussion with Ella Shepherd from Al Rand's Abortion Rights Aotearoa.
And we'll also look back at Rosetta's chat with climate justice lead at Oxfam Aotearoa, Nick Henry, about phasing out fossil fuels in the Pacific. Hei aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka oe e wariwari, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kororo anō he pakihere roki roki maoranga, iti pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com and catch all of these stories that have already been podcasted on the website 95BFM.com, and you can also check out the full show after the show is, so if, in case you miss anything and you want to listen back to what happened this year. Let's get started.
Fantastic.
Great.
Super.
The best of The Wire on 95BFM.
Following the general election, Rosetta had a kōrero with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp about the party's success in the election. They also spoke about Takutai's priorities for Tamaki Makaurau and their concerns about the new National Act New Zealand First Coalition's policies. Here is that interview.
So firstly, congratulations on your win of the Tamaki Makaurau electorate. Could you speak a little bit about your priorities for Tamaki Makaurau over the next 3 years as the elected MP?
Well, mōrena, and thank you. Firstly, we just want to mihi to all our whānau who got out there and voted for an Aotearoa hau, got out there and voted for their whakapapa, for their mukapuna, and for an Aotearoa hau. It was Tamaki Makaurau had been asking for change in the seat of Tamaki Makaurau, and our whānau believed in them, they believed in themselves, and they got out there and voted. So a big mihi to all our whānau who did that. You know, we campaigned over the last 10 months all around cost of living, all around ensuring our whānau were living in a tiriti-centric Aotearoa, and we fought for our whakapapa. So the key priorities really, especially from what we've been hearing across the last 10 months, has been around the cost of living. Whānau here in Tamaki Makaurau are struggling to pay their rent, struggling to put kai on the table, struggling to put petrol in their petrol tanks, and they're struggling with normal day-to-day activities of life, and there's a lot of struggle out here in our community. So our priorities will be looking at the cost of living. But now that we have a new government and their manifesto has been put out to all of us across the country, our priority in the first instance will be around the tiriti or waitangi and looking at ensuring that our people rise up and unite around fighting against ensuring we fight for the rights of our whakapapa for Te Reo, for a Te Reiti Centre of Aotearoa.
So there's been huge success for Te Pāti Māori in this election, winning a total of 6 electorate seats. What difference will the jump from 2 seats in Parliament to 6 mean?
Well, what it means is that there are more of us in Parimata, more of us that are tangata whenua, that are Te Reiti centric, that will fight for our people and fight for the rights of our culture, of our reo, to be heard, and to ensure that we are here for whānau and listening to the ground and ensuring that our voices are heard. And that's what it will be for us. We will be, you've always heard Rawiri talk about being that annoying people in your shoe. Well, now we've got a seabed of peoples that are here to fight for our people. Ka whaiwhai tonu mātou.
After the coalition agreement announced on Friday, which policies outlined by the new government are Te Pāti Māori most concerned about?
Well, the first one we're really concerned about is the review of the principles of the Te Reiti o Waitangi. You know, and you can already feel and hear amongst our people their concern around the challenges of that. You know, we really feel that, you know, our reo, our culture is being challenged, and we can already hear our whānau telling us what it is that they want. They want us to fight, they want us to stand up, they want us to challenge. You know, the Te Reiti o Waitangi is our covenant document, and our tūpuna allowed for Pākehā to be here, and, you know, it's not a document that we feel should be challenged in the way it is, and we really feel that our people are being, you know, anything Māori is being challenged, and Te Pāti Māori, that's one of the biggest things Te Pāti Māori will now be looking at. We were always, you know, we've always been fighting for a Te Reiti-centric Aotearoa, but our people will actually tell us, and you can hear already that whānau are starting to come together. Whānau hapu and iwi are starting to unite around a united response.
Could you speak a little bit about the future of the Māori Health Authority as well?
Yeah, that's very disappointing around the Māori Health Authority around Te Aka Whai Ora. I mean, I was part of the Māori Expert Advisory Group that helped with the writing of the alternative paper in the review, in the House review, the Simpson review. You know, we fought really hard to have, you know, a different approach to looking at the health and well-being of our people. Māori died 7 years earlier than Pākehā. There needs to be a different approach and system for the way that healthcare for Māori, not just all Māori, actually for Māori, so that we can, you know, challenge. The current system doesn't work for us. But Te Aka Whai Ora was our alternative view. So for Te Aka Whai Ora to be removed as that alternative health system for Māori is another challenge we fight with. I know that the incoming Minister of Health was also against Te Aka Whai Ora, and they wanted to remove that. It is disappointing. It is disappointing to hear. And, you know, our people have worked really hard in the health sector. Many Māori have been, really fought for this. I mean, there was a lot of consultation by a lot of Māori providers, a lot of partners, a lot of community organisations that fought for the Aka Whai Ora, and now that's being removed. So that's going to be another challenge, another kaupapa that Te Pāti Māori will face, and will have to challenge and push back on this.
That was Rosetta speaking to Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp about the party's success in the election. They also spoke about Takutai's priorities for Tamaki Makaurau and which policies they are most concerned about from the government.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Rallies to protest against the new government plans to repeal the smoke-free legislation took place in Wellington and Auckland last week, with 1,000 people gathering in front of Parliament and another few hundred marching to ACT leader David Seymour's electorate office. The smoke-free legislation passed in 2022 stopped those who were born after January 2009 from legally buying cigarettes and was designed to prevent thousands of smoking-related deaths as well as save the health system with a lot of money. So far, despite the recent decrease in smoking, around 5,000 people die each year in Aotearoa because of smoking or secondhand smoke exposure. We also saw more than 100 union members and politicians protesting outside the ACT Party office in Epsom in response to the plans to scrap the Fair Pay Agreement, a system that was put in place to ensure bargaining for minimum employment terms for all covered employees in an industry or occupation. Today, I spoke to ACT MP Simon Court about ACT's response to these protests and inquired about the strategies proposed to mitigate these concerns.
The Māori Public Health Group Papai Te Haora presented a petition signed by about 47,000 people urging the government not to go through with a repeal of smoke-free laws, and that was sent to Te Pāti Māori co-leader Debbie Nauria Packer. Repealing these smoke-free laws was an ACT Party policy. What led to the ACT Party to prioritise this issue in coalition negotiations?
It's because if the laws passed by the previous Labor government were rolled out, then they would have led to some pretty significant negative outcomes. When you look at the way prohibition of other substances has led to a black market, even though, and people haven't stopped using them, and you can only look at, you know, drugs, for example, or when different countries tried to prohibit alcohol, it just led to really negative outcomes in a black market. What ACT would say is, look, trajectory of smokers, you know, is declining. The number of people smoking is declining. While there might be pockets of people who are resistant to giving up, overall the trend is going in the right direction. The last thing we want to do is introduce a whole lot of repressive prohibition type legislation to control smoking when, you know, prohibition doesn't work.
Is the ACT Party committed to lowering smoking rates?
Over time, and the evidence is that smoking rates are coming down and have come down significantly. I mean, when I was a young person, you know, back in the 1980s, I think New Zealanders were smoking at a rate of 30 to 40% of the population. Now it's somewhere between 6 and 8%, I understand. So we're keen to see those rates come down further, but we don't think that prohibition is the way to go.
Long term, what impact do you expect removing the smoke-free legislation will have?
Well, none, because the legislation hadn't taken effect. It was due to come into effect in 2025. And so we simply retained the status quo, which means that, you know, based on the current trajectory, smoking rates will continue to decline. So we think that's positive. But removing the legislation, which hadn't been implemented, won't have any effect.
Are there any alternatives that the ACT Party might propose to reduce these smoking rates?
No, we haven't considered that. We're just really, really concerned that some of the poorly designed legislation passed by the previous government was halted before it could be implemented and do damage.
Thousands of people, including health professionals, have rallied across the country last week, and this is against the government removing this legislation. What health experts have you consulted to make this decision?
Well, it was a policy that we campaigned on, because ACT had advice, as had other parts of government, that introducing the bans such as zero nicotine cigarettes and reducing the number of retail outlets across the entire country to only 600 would have severe negative outcomes. And so that's the advice that ACT received. And so that's why we campaigned during the election campaign to stop that policy going ahead. We were successful. We're part of a government that was elected on that mandate. And so that's why we've enacted that policy. And with all due respect to the people who've protested about it, you know, we appreciate they have a right to protest, but, you know, a new government's been elected, we have a mandate, and we're enacting the policies that were part of our coalition manifesto.
Looking at statistics, 17.1% of Māori were smokers and were three times as likely to be current smokers than their non-Māori counterparts. What Māori groups and organisations have ACT consulted in regards to the effects of removing the smoke-free legislation?
I wasn't involved in the development of our policy. I'm a civil engineer, and, you know, my background is in environmental science and fixing up old landfills. But I understand that the party and our MPs who worked on that policy had advice from various groups as to what the negative outcomes were of enacting that policy. We still want to see smoking rates continue to decline. Yeah, they have declined significantly over the past 20 to 30 years, and we think that on the current trajectory with the controls that are in place, that should continue.
So Colin Tituitonga has stepped down from his role in Te Whatu Ora, and he stated that he has no confidence in the government to deliver these outcomes for Māori and Pacific people. Does ACT believe removing smoke-free legislation will help Māori?
Well, we think it's a benefit to all people that the legislation passed by the previous Labor government, which had not been implemented, does not proceed, because we do not think that introducing zero nicotine cigarettes, which haven't been produced anywhere else in the world, have never been trialled in a market, we're going to work. We don't think that creeping prohibition would work, and we don't think reducing the number of retail outlets to 600 across the entire country would work. So if Mr. Tuiatonga thinks that he can't work with the current coalition government, that's fine. He's made a decision based on his principles, and we wish him all the best.
Last week, we saw more than 100 union members and some politicians protesting outside the ACT Party office in Epsom against the government scrapping fair pay agreements, which is also an ACT Party policy. What can you say to these people that believe you do not have workers' best rights interests as a priority?
Well, they're wrong, and scrapping fair pay agreements was policy that ACT campaigned on. We're part of the government. It's in the coalition agreement. When the previous Labor government passed those fair pay agreements, in every opportunity that ACT MPs and our party had, we spoke out against them and we outlined why we didn't believe they would work or help workers. And I'll just give you one example. When I spoke to people in the supermarket industry, they said, we're being forced to negotiate three separate fair pay agreements that cover an individual worker. And I said, how is that possible? Aren't they supposed to be like for all workers across the country who work in the supermarket? And they said, no. What it would mean is that if you start off in the morning working in the deli, in the middle of the day you stock shelves, and in the afternoon you work on the till, that's fresh food service, one's warehousing, and the other one is retail front of house. Three fair pay agreements. How on earth is one worker supposed to be covered by three fair pay agreements? They can't run a business like that. Even the employees wouldn't know whether they're Arthur or Martha. So the whole thing was impractical. That's why no agreements had actually advanced beyond the tag you get an agreement by the unions, and ACT campaigned on it because it wasn't a practical policy. It's not going to make it easier to employ people or give employers flexibility so their businesses can grow and become productive. And that's why we campaigned against them, and that's why the policy and that legislation was repealed last week.
So do you believe removing fair pay agreements will benefit workers?
Well, fair pay agreements have not been enacted. The law was passed, none were implemented, so at the moment we're just at the status quo. No one wins, no one loses. We're just exactly where we were last week. There were no fair pay agreements. All we've done is simply repeal the law that would have enabled them.
Would you agree that the ACT Party policy, namely repealing some free legislation and fair pay agreements, are unpopular within low-income workers and vulnerable communities?
No, we wouldn't agree with that at all. Most people have never heard of fair pay agreements and would have had no idea how they would have actually been implemented or affected them. What people are interested in, though, is that if they want a high-paid job, then they know that they should be able to find one. And we can only really ensure that there are higher-paying jobs in the regions and in our cities if our businesses are more productive and aren't tied down by red tape, like having to negotiate fair pay agreements with multiple unions for a single employee, for example. There's no country in the world that's successful by tying its businesses up in red tape like that. What we need to do is focus on productivity, so removing fair pay agreements and reintroducing as the next stage of our employment reforms 90-day trials is really important, because what that will mean is for the most vulnerable workers, for people who leave prison with a big tattoo on their face and struggle to get employment, an employer is much more likely to take them on, knowing that if they don't work out for any reason, essentially a very easy process to say, we'll take you on, but if you don't work out, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. Whereas at the moment, if you take somebody on, you're taking on a whole lot of risk. It's very, very hard to terminate or end a person's employment if they turn out to be a poor fit for your business. So you know, we think the next stage is to reintroduce 90-day trials, which will give a whole lot more potential employees a much greater chance of actually finding employment.
How will the government guarantee businesses deliver fair pay and safe working conditions to their employees?
Well, we have minimum wage rules, and we have the Health and Safety Work Act, which puts legal requirements on employers to make sure they keep their workers safe in the workplace.
And finally, as we approach the new year, what plans do the ACT Party have for the near future that you can tell us about?
We've got an exciting week coming up this week. In the House, the government is going to repeal the Natural and Built Environments Act and the Spatial Planning Act. And as a civil engineer and somebody who's been involved in planning and obtaining consents and building infrastructure, I was really quite disturbed at what the previous Labor government's legislation was going to do. It was going to make it harder to plan, design and build. We're going to repeal that legislation. We're going to preserve a fast-track process for important projects. And next year, we'll be coming back to start the design of a long-term reform of the planning and consenting process in New Zealand, which should make it much easier for big infrastructure, small infrastructure and land development projects to go ahead. And what that means is that we'll have better cities to live in, higher densities, and with better infrastructure to get around, cleaner water, and all of these things enabled by better funding and financing tools. So that's what I'll be doing on behalf of the ACT Party this week and when I come back in the new year.
That was ACT's Simon Court.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party. The best of The Wire on 95BFM.
As part of the coalition deal between National ACT and New Zealand First, the government intends to remove gender, sexuality and relationship-based education from the school curriculum. In 2020, former New Zealand First MP and Minister Tracy Martin introduced Relationship and Sexuality Education, or RSC, guidelines, supporting schools to provide a safe space for young people to learn about themselves and being respectful towards others. Now, current Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters is reversing this policy. Oran's abortion rights Aotearoa recently released a statement condemning the government's plan to remove RSC from school curricula, arguing that the government would be ignoring decades of evidence-based research carried out in Aotearoa and overseas. I discussed the removal of RSC with Ella Shepherd, president of Oran's abortion rights Aotearoa, further. Here is that interview.
Could you provide some background on Oran's and their goals regarding reproduction rights and education?
Certainly. So Oran's is New Zealand's oldest standing pro-choice organisation. We were founded in 1970 and advocated for the legalisation of abortion in Aotearoa, and since then have taken a more holistic approach to advocating for access to good reproductive health care and education about reproductive decisions.
Why is relationship and sexuality education important?
It's incredibly important because it helps students know what healthy relationships are and, by extension, what unhealthy relationships are. It helps students understand consent and critical thinking. It encompasses a wide range of things, knowing about your body, about reproductive changes, about puberty, about sexual education. It encompasses a whole part of our lives that's important for students to understand at an early age.
Would you be able to provide some context into the new government's plan to remove the relationship and sex education from the school curricula?
Certainly. So the current RSC guidelines were implemented by New Zealand First MP Tracy Martin in 2020, and now they're coming out of the curriculum because of New Zealand First leader and now Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters. It's part of New Zealand First's kind of broader, more populist platform to remove reference to things like LGBTQ relationships and rights in education and a more conservative approach through teaching in schools.
How is the removal of RSC from school curricula, how would that affect our students?
Well, first of all, they'll be missing out on a core part of education, which is understanding about healthy relationships, understanding about sexuality, understanding about consent, learning things about your body, knowing what is normal, what is okay, encouraging students to have critical thinking skills about what they are comfortable with, both in terms of reproductive choices, but also with their sexuality. So that is of big concern, but more broadly, it's quite concerning to see this government take a really reactionary and fundamentalist view that is out of line with evidence-based research. The majority of parents, when they know what RSE is, support it. RSE has been tied with greater understanding of things like consent, reducing sexual violence with young people, and encouraging healthy relationships. So it's concerning to see a government that is not legislating based on that and what's best for our students, but is legislating from a place of blind ideology.
Are there any specific concerns about the potential consequences on access to the information and services related to reproductive health?
Well, it just takes us back. It takes us back in time, and we thought we'd made progress by introducing key concepts such as consent into everyday education. So it's really concerning for us to see the removal of things like that. Schools should be a place where students can go and learn and challenge themselves and ask questions and debate things in positive and respectful ways with each other. So removing a safe forum to learn about these things and explore these ideas is incredibly concerning and means that it will rely on individuals to seek out that education themselves, which, as we know from the past, isn't the best way about it and leads to unhealthy relationships, a lack of understanding about consent and a lack of understanding about reproduction and bodily autonomy.
What can the audience do to help raise awareness of the consequences of removing RSE from school curricula?
Certainly, well, the typical advice is always write to your local MP and say that this is something that you feel strongly about and you disagree and you think it's important that it remains in our curriculum and it's evidence-based and it's science-based, and we want students in a curriculum that is evidence-based and science-based that can support young people to kind of lead, you know, reach their full potential and lead fulsome lives where they understand things like consent. So write to your local MP and say that this reactionary view doesn't represent your views and it certainly doesn't represent the views of the majority of New Zealanders. Also, if you've got children or young people, writing to individual school boards to express your concern about that would be another thing. Say that it's important for your children to learn about these things and that the school board has parental support to continue with these programs.
Finally, I'd just like to ask, is there anything else you'd like to add in regards to this topic?
No, just that it's concerning of a more indicative trend. Obviously, you know, speaking from an abortion rights organisation, we have a government that has ostensibly promised not to restrict abortion access and to kind of legislate and in line with facts and science and broader public opinion and research. And it's concerning to see that this is the start of chipping away at those sorts of freedoms. It's very reminiscent of an American-style don't say gay bill. A large part of it is objection to referencing LGBTQ people in schools, and we see it as the beginning of a slippery slope to erosions of further rights that have been hard won and hard fought, like access to abortion care, like access to contraception, things like that. So it's certainly concerning in and of itself, but it's also concerning about what it means for how this government is going to legislate moving forward, and we're seeing a kind of fundamentalist regression, and I think we need to be on high alert that other rights that we take for granted and other parts of our society that we take for granted might also be under threat with this new government. Also, this is something that has come from young people themselves. The push to have consent education, which is part of RSE in schools, is something that young people have said, we want this, we need this, this is an important part of our lives and we would like to be taught this and have this as part of our school curriculum. So it's, I think, particularly insulting that young people are asking for this and it's the old people that are taking it away. I think it's a sign of how you can expect this new government to legislate more broadly by ignoring vast fourth of the population that are most affected by their decisions, and instead making decisions based on their own ideology rather than the facts and the science that support evidence-based policies.
That was Alice Shepherd, president of Elrun's Abortion Rights Aotearoa, on the removal of RSC.
Old news!
The best of The Wire on 95BFM.
Earlier this year, ministers from six Pacific states issued the Port Vila call for a global, just and equitable phase out of coal, oil and gas, calling on Pacific leaders to show their support in a leaders' declaration at the Pacific Islands Forum. Oxfam Aotearoa called for New Zealand and Australia to support a fossil fuel-free Pacific. Rosetta spoke to Nick Henry, climate justice lead at Oxfam Aotearoa, about phasing out fossil fuels and whether this is a realistic goal under the new government. Here is that interview.
Could you explain what the Port Vila call for a just transition to a fossil fuel-free Pacific is?
Yeah, so it's an outcome of a really impressive meeting that happened in March this year in Port Vila in Vanuatu of the climate ministers of six countries in the Pacific. And they came together in the aftermath of the cyclones that have hit Vanuatu, Judy and Kevin, earlier in that month, actually. And so those climate ministers and the Prime Minister of Vanuatu, climate ministers from Tonga, Fiji, Niue, Solomons, Tuvalu and Vanuatu, agreed on a really bold statement to call for the full phase out with a just transition of fossil fuels in the Pacific region. And the reason they did that is because it's fossil fuels that are creating the climate crisis that are threatening the existence and survival of Pacific communities. So they're really sort of stepping up to that challenge and saying that they will do their bit, even though they've contributed the least to the problem. But in order to, I think, have the moral high ground, which they have really shown, to call on others to do the same. So calling on New Zealand and Australia to make the same commitments, and then to take that to the global stage at the UN Conference of Parties or COP meetings in December. So that's made the news again. That happened in March. It's made the news again this week because it's been acknowledged and reaffirmed at the Leaders Summit of the Pacific Islands Forum that's just finished last week.
And how popular has this initiative been amongst Pacific nations as of recent?
Well, I think really popular. It's a really bold and visionary statement, the Port Vila call. It talks very clearly about where the problem lies with the fossil fuel industry. It rejects the arguments for continuing the production and use of fossil fuels any longer than is absolutely necessary. So it talks about a fast and just transition to build up the alternatives at the same time as reducing production and use in fossil fuels. And that's key because we really are in the crisis now, so we need to ramp down fossil fuel production with speed. And a just transition means making sure that we, at the same time, create the alternatives for good jobs and renewable energy, for community access to electricity. And we know that we have the technology to do that with solar and wind and tidal power and hydropower. If it's at an appropriate scale, then at the community level, then communities can really benefit from those new technologies, especially, and they're not that new, right? Tuvalu's been, Tokelau rather, has been on solar power for over a decade now, fully powered by the sun, and other Pacific Islands want that too because they see the benefits of energy self-sufficiency, not having to import expensive diesel fuel and rely on that. So there's a lot of benefits to communities of making that transition, but there's also a lot of urgency in ending the use of fossil fuels as fast as possible. And that means ending new projects that would produce more fossil fuels. And that means ending any plans to go looking for more. So it's a time when New Zealand really needs to consider whether this is the right time to be reopening exploration for oil and gas
offshore, and Oxfam is saying it's not, because the Pacific is calling us to do the opposite, to phase down and to end our production of fossil fuels. So the leaders at the Pacific Island Forum, they reaffirmed that aspiration to a just and equitable transition to a fossil fuel-free Pacific, but they went further than aspiration. And that was a bit of a concern that we had leading up to the meeting, that New Zealand especially was talking about aspirational language, whereas Pacific leaders were talking about practical commitment. And where they seem to have landed is both, which is great, because aspiration is all very well as long as you back it with practical action and actually do something to actually end the use of fossil fuels. And what's really significant, reading the communique that's just come out from the Pacific Islands Forum meeting on Friday, late on Friday, this communique comes out that all leaders of the Pacific Islands Forum, and remembering that this includes New Zealand and Australia, have committed to the transition away from coal, oil and gas in our energy systems, in line with IPCC pathways for limiting global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees, with a peak in fossil fuel consumption in the near term. And that's quite technical language, but it's really strong stuff, actually, because what that would mean would be reducing our production and use of fossil fuels by 50% by 2030 and 100% by 2050, if we're going to actually keep to those IPCC pathways. And I can explain what that means, but that's the reality, that we need to rapidly reduce our fossil fuel production and use.
So you've mentioned Pacific nations who are already leading the way to sustainable energy. How crucial really are Australia and New Zealand in seeing this call come to action?
Well, absolutely crucial, because if we talk about fossil fuel production in the Pacific, that is Australia and it is New Zealand. New Zealand has, in global terms, relatively small as a proportion of our economy industry producing oil for export. We don't actually use any of that in New Zealand. We export the crude oil and then re-import different petrol and diesel. We've got a relatively small industry producing lignite coal for export, and some of that we burn here and some more we import again from Indonesian coal and others, and a gas industry that only supplies New Zealand, but a lot of the products of that are actually chemical products like methanol or fertilizer, and a large amount of those are exported. But in terms of our economy, this is like 1 or 2% of our exports, 1% in the case of oil, and maybe a little bit more if you count the coal and the methanol. But there are economies in the world like Iraq that have over 80% of their economy based on oil production. We all need to phase it out, but that's going to be a big challenge for some of those poorer developing countries that are heavily dependent on oil or fossil fuel production. New Zealand actually has the capacity to diversify our economy and not rely on these dirty, polluting, planet-killing fuels as our exports, and we have a responsibility to do that. So when the Pacific leaders, including our own, say that we're committed to ending fossil fuels in line with the IPCC pathways, that's referring to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that says we have to reduce emissions from fossil fuels by 48%, so about half, by 2030. And the only safe way to reduce emissions from fossil fuels is to reduce our production and use of fossil fuels. Otherwise, you're trying to like capture gas and store it in the ground, and that's risky, it's dangerous, even if it works. Most of the time it doesn't work, and it doesn't work when you're talking about burning fuel in cars and so on that's distributed into the atmosphere. So production and consumption of fossil fuels really go together. And if we're serious about those pathways of staying within any kind of safe climate limits, we need to rapidly end our use of fossil fuels. And I guess the other thing I'd say about, I think I'm actually wrong to say safe climate limits, because we're past that already. You know, we're in a climate crisis, so we're already causing harm. And every kilogram, every ton of carbon dioxide that is produced now, including from the coal and the oil and the gas that New Zealand is still digging up and that our government is saying we want to go looking for more of. Every amount of carbon dioxide from here on is causing harm, to Pacific communities who are facing extreme weather and sea level rise, including in Aotearoa, people who are dying in heat waves and droughts. You know, every amount of fossil fuels we use between now and when we finally phase them out will cause harm to people. So it's a matter of just reducing it as fast as we can, really, from now.
Christopher Luxon has plans to scrap the ban on offshore oil and gas exploration. Is the idea of pledging to a fossil fuel-free Pacific completely out of the question under a national government?
Well, the thing is that we have signed up to it with this leaders' declaration at the forum attended by our current government, represented by Carmel Cipollone, but also with Gerry Brownlee there as a part of the delegation representing the incoming government. So that will be a question for the government to answer, how they will reconcile their commitment to stand with the Pacific in this declaration to end our use of fossil fuels as a region in line with the IPCC pathways. We know that we can't do that while looking for more oil and gas. In fact, the IPCC and the International Energy Agency tell us that a large proportion of the currently known reserves can't be burned. And independent research says that it's 60% of oil and gas reserves and coal reserves can't be used if we're to keep within those boundaries. So it's really absurd to think that we can then go and look, explore for more oil and gas. And in fact, the IPCC and the International Energy Agency say that we can't. So that's the science. That's the facts of the matter. It's also a declining industry globally. Demand is set to peak and then decline. So it's really not going to be the economic future of New Zealand either. And we think that the government needs to take a hard look at that and decide not to go ahead with expanding offshore exploration.
Alongside phasing out fossil fuels, how responsible should New Zealand be for playing a part in helping Pacific nations that are already feeling the effects of climate change?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And in fact, that's a large focus of what Oxfam Aotearoa does and advocates for. As we stand with the Pacific on these calls to limit our emissions and do the most that we can to stop the climate crisis getting worse, we also stand with communities and give, Oxfam and other organisations give direct support to Pacific communities to help them to adapt, reduce the impact of the climate crisis on them, but also to raise their voices and to influence their governments and the world's governments to make sure that they have, for instance, support to respond to loss and damage caused by climate crises and extreme weather, like the cyclones in Vanuatu. We've just had another one, Cyclone Lola, and the devastation from that is really affecting communities, and they need support to respond, to cope with that loss and damage caused. So New Zealand does contribute climate finance in the Pacific. We do a good job compared to a lot of governments of giving grants rather than loans. We've increased our climate finance in recent years, and I think New Zealand has had a good approach to that recently. We're going to need to be part of the global conversation about the increasing need as the crisis gets worse, and increasingly we're seeing, the climate crisis is here. It's not a future problem or possibility. It's a now problem, and it's increasing the needs for humanitarian response, loss and damage response finance and climate finance to help Pacific and other countries transition their energy systems and also be more resilient to the climate change that is happening. So there's a lot of need out there. New Zealand has established a good track record of supporting communities with their needs, and we hope that will continue, and globally the needs are only going to increase. So there will be increasing calls on New Zealand and other countries to continue to stand with the Pacific and other countries affected.
That was climate justice lead at Oxfam Aotearoa, Nick Henry talking about phasing out fossil fuels, and we'll be back right after this quick break.
Merry Christmas! What did Santa bring everybody?
Wow, some undies. Thanks, Santa.
Wow! A Leica M11 monochrome and a range of professional quality lenses. Santa, you're the best!
No, what? Wait, why did you get a better gift?
I asked Santa for it. What did you ask for?
World peace? Whoops.
Ding Dong Merrily on High. Find all the photography ding dongs you need to make your Yuletide gay at ProGear. Open now at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or go to progear.co.nz.
Take the stress out of Christmas with Tiger Drops Holy CBG Hemp Oil. Plus, you get a free 15ml with every 30ml purchase. That's two Holy CBG Hemp Oils for the price of one.
Tiger Drops are not intended for consumption or for the treatment or prevention of any disease or condition. Sales support judicial review of CBD consumption in New Zealand. For more info, head to tigerdrops.com.
You've heard of Save the Bee.
Well, now get ready for Rave the Bee.
The official Save the Bee after party.
Wednesday, December 20 at Whammy, Backroom and Wine Cellar.
Featuring
Deep State,
Dubhead,
Half Hexagon,
Half Queen plus Zeki,
Log Cabin,
Miss Dom,
North Shore Pony Club,
Penny Raven Black,
Polly Hill,
Samuel Harmony,
Scarlotta,
Stinky Jim,
Thea,
The Professor,
The Swap Meet, Rave the Bee.
December 20 from 10pm till 4am.
Whammy, Backroom and Wine Cellar.
Tickets are $35 from undertheradar.co.nz.
Some current affairs age like fine wine. The Best of The Wire on 95BFM.
Welcome back to The Wire. Research from the University of Otago in Wellington from earlier this year found healthcare professionals are concerned about the management of endometrial cancer in Aotearoa. Despite other cancer rates staying the same or going down, cases of endometrial cancer have increased over the past 10 years in New Zealand. I spoke to co-author Dr. Claire Henry, scientist and lecturer at the University of Otago in Wellington, about this further. Here is this interview now.
Firstly, for those who may not be familiar, could you explain what endometrial cancer is, its causes, and how it affects its individuals?
Absolutely. So endometrial cancer is the cancer that grows in the lining of the uterus. So the lining is called the endometrium. So that's where we get endometrial cancer from. So the symptoms of endometrial cancer are kind of abnormal uterine bleeding or postmenopausal bleeding. And often in younger women, abnormal bleeding can be, you know, heavy bleeding, bleeding between periods, periods that kind of soak through pads or tampons quite a lot. So those are the things to kind of look out for. The risk factor, there's a few risk factors for endometrial cancer, but one of the strongest ones is actually obesity or high weight, which I think is something people don't really know about. And so that has to do with estrogen. So there's a few ways that estrogen and high weight can lead to endometrial cancer. But really what it comes down to is that estrogen is an important molecule in our menstrual cycle, and it helps grow the lining to get ready for pregnancy. But if we have high weight, it can actually increase the amount of estrogen in our body. And so increased estrogen over a long period of time can stimulate our lining to keep growing and keep growing. And so then our lining can become thick, and then as it gets thickened, it can lead to cancer further down the line. Something that is really important in Aotearoa is that endometrial cancer rates are rising, and it's actually rising in younger women. So the standard of care for endometrial cancer is a hysterectomy or removal of the uterus. And what we're seeing is when younger people are coming in with endometrial cancer, they have to have a hysterectomy, and that can really impact, you know, their ability or choice to have a family. It can really, you know, impact quality of life as well.
This was brought up from some research that was done recently in regards to the management of endometrial cancer. Would you be able to explain how that research was conducted?
Yeah, sure. So This research project really looked at health professionals' views of the current state of endometrial cancer in Aotearoa. So we kind of know that in this space, the rising rates of cancer are quite a concern, but this piece was a qualitative kind of interviews with health professionals across the country, trying to get an understanding of what's going on, what's the problems, and really, yeah, what are the problems with management of endometrial cancer as well. The work was led by Linda Williams, who's a clinical dietitian doing a PhD here in Wellington. And basically, we really found that there was an overwhelming concern with the rising rates of endometrial cancer. And what health professionals thought was that because of the younger women coming in and the association with high weight, there's kind of a problem around managing. So high weight can impact surgery, so it can make surgery more complicated. You can also be a high risk of surgery if you have high weight, so maybe you might not be able to have surgery. And there's also increased complications post-surgery with high weight. So this was kind of some of the things that the health professionals were talking about.
Are there any factors that might contribute to the rise of endometrial cancer in the country? Is there, like you mentioned, high weight?
Yeah, so it's definitely partly due to the rising rates of obesity in Aotearoa, but it's not the full reason. There's complexities around this that we still don't fully understand, but it is one of the main risk factors. So out of all cancers, endometrial cancer has the strongest association with high weight. And that kind of impacting the changing landscape of the age of women that we're seeing. So endometrial cancer used to be a disease that, you know, older postmenopausal women were being diagnosed with. But yeah, now we're seeing women as young as 30 being diagnosed. So that's really concerning. The other thing is with the rising rates, we've kind of known about this for at least 5 years. So I think it's really time we do something about it. And, you know, we've kind of gone from about 300 women being diagnosed, you know, in year 2000 to now about 800 women being diagnosed in 2020. And it's just, you know, skyrocketing up. So generally other cancers are on a downward trend, but endometrial cancer is just, it's going up.
Are there any specific challenges or gaps in the healthcare infrastructure that are also related to this issue?
Well, I mean, we know there's lots of gaps and challenges in the healthcare system overall, don't we? Really, with endometrial cancer, I think we need support for our, you know, overworked healthcare system. We need support for culturally appropriate holistic care because we're seeing more Pacifica women in particular with this cancer. We also need more hospital resourcing, you know, for women who might need longer hospital stays. And we need more resourcing for, you know, support and increased support for women with complications post-surgery. So there's, you know, there's a lot of things that we need to do in the healthcare system. But I think kind of the other thing we need is more awareness around endometrial cancer. It's not a well-known cancer at all, but it's the most common gynecological cancer. And there's really no awareness around what it is or maybe the symptoms, which is the heavy menstrual bleeding or the post-menstrual bleeding that I talked about. There's also really no awareness around the risk factors between, you know, high weight and endometrial cancer. So I think that conversation, really needs to be out there and to be happening.
That actually leads me on to my next question, was like, how can we actually contribute to raising awareness and also supporting those that are affected by endometrial cancer?
Yeah, so I think raising awareness can really start with those conversations with friends and family, hey. So even conversations around what normal periods are, you know, is it heavy? Is it light? Is it more than 5 to 7 days? You know, some people might be experiencing heavy bleeding for a really long time, but not actually realize that that's abnormal. It might just be normal for them, if that makes sense. So kind of, I think breaking down those barriers around talking about periods is important. In terms of supporting people with endometrial cancer, you know, it's about supporting anyone with cancer, isn't it? Being there for them, helping with whatever they need. Any, you know, whānau help, family help that they might need as well. Especially young women that might be diagnosed with endometrial cancer. It can be isolating and it can be, you know, a really scary time, and especially because it's our uterus and it's our womb, it's really an important kind of cancer, actually, yeah, and it can really be quite an individual experience as well.
When discussing the impact of endometrial cancer, I mentioned endometriosis. Claire then explained that endometrial cancer and endometriosis were two different medical issues.
So I know you weren't asking this question, but I do get this question a lot. Yeah, like, is endometriosis and endometrial cancer kind of related at all, or are they similar in any ways? And the answer is absolutely not. They really don't have anything to do with each other. They just kind of sound the same because it's that endometrium word. So endometriosis is when tissue that kind of looks like the lining of our uterus is in places that it shouldn't be. So maybe it's stuck to the bowel or stuck to our bladder or something like that. But endometrial cancer is the cancer that grows inside the lining of the uterus. So yeah, so they're quite different. But you're right in that something that affects your uterus and your cycle and your, you know, pelvic pain and stuff like that, it's really detrimental to people's quality of life. And it's really important for us to talk about just menstrual health in general, I think, yeah.
That was Dr. Claire Henry on the rise of endometrial cancer in Aotearoa.
That was The Year That Was, the best of The Wire on 95BFM. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire for 2023. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.